The Blackshaw Arts Hour on Wandsworth Radio, where you listen with your ears and not your mouth.
Good evening. You are listening to the Blackshaw Arts Hour on Wandsworth Radio. We have a full studio this week. This week we've got Ellie back by popular demand.
Hello.
Helen is also here.
Hi.
And Matt, as usual.
Hello there.
We've got a really full show this week. We're going to hear an interview with some of our friends over at Cypher's Theatre. They are putting on Henry V in a couple of weeks, and I caught up with them this week. We're also going to be talking a lot about staying alive and hearing some cast interviews, and Helen's going to be talking about Photograph 51, I believe.
Yes, indeed.
Yes, but the first thing that we're going to do, which I'm very excited about this week, by the way, is this.
The Matt Boothman Film Review. So good, I put my trousers back on.
Matt, you are doing The Martian, are you not?
I am. So The Martian is the newest addition to the Lost on Your Own in Space subgenre of movies. So a few years ago we had Moon by Duncan Jones, which was about Sam Rockwell being lonely on the moon.
Mm-hmm.
And a few years ago, a bit more recently, we had Gravity by Alfonso Cuarón, which was about space being really hostile to Sandra Bullock. And now we have The Martian by Ridley Scott, adapted from the novel by Andy Weir, which is about Matt Damon Robinson Crusoed on Mars. So roughly speaking, Matt Damon is... Mark Watney. He's a botanist who's part of a science team studying Mars. Something goes wrong. Everybody has to leave. Mark Watney gets left behind and has to survive on Mars for long enough to signal home and get rescued.
Yes.
So where Moon was about sort of the psychological effects of loneliness and remoteness, and Gravity was about how hostile space is, The Martian's really about the ingenuity. It really focuses in on the creativity that you would have to survive that situation. And it's an example of a sort of a grand old sci-fi tradition that has sort of gone out of fashion a little bit. The puzzle box story, where you set up a situation with a lot of problems and have the characters solve it using science. This used to be all the rage in science fiction, and it's sort of out of fashion now. This is a really good example of it. So it's sort of a great big thought experiment. It's Andy Weir has written this book basically asking, could somebody survive being marooned on Mars? What would they need to survive? What would they need to do? So he'd need to grow his own food. He'd need to create water to do that. He'd need to signal home, etc., etc., etc. What things going wrong could and couldn't he survive? So stepping back a bit from it, having watched it, the plot is sort of almost quite convenient for him, as much as everything seems to be going wrong, and every time he seems to be able to relax, something new goes wrong that he has to deal with. There's still, I noticed, he keeps talking about if my air fails or if my water fails, I will die. And he mentions it so many times that I thought that one of them was going to fail at one point, and neither of them ever do. So it's sort of, the things that can go wrong without killing him for the plot, for plot purposes, do go wrong. So it's a bit convenient in that way, but it's all in service of showing how, if somebody was marooned, could we eventually get them back?
Yeah.
One of those things is, what sort of personality type would that person need? So Matt Damon plays this character who is, if you put him in a different situation, you might think he was a bit full of himself.
Yeah, that's true, actually. Yeah.
So
I interrupt you.
Because I suspect you were about to say you quite liked him, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
so
I
much.
Really liked him as well. He had me from the line, Mars will come to fear my botany powers.
Yeah. He's so funny as well.
Yeah.
I think that really comes out of the writing. From what I've heard from people reading the book, he's a hilariously funny character, and the reason you really want him to succeed is because he is so funny and fun, and he takes the piss out of the situation he finds himself in.
Yeah, so he does a lot of these sort of diary pieces to camera, to all the cameras in his habitat that he's living in on Mars, which there was a point where I thought, who is he actually doing these for? Because he's explaining everything in terms that the audience of the movie can understand. And I'm thinking,
for us, Matt, sitting in the cinema.
Because if he's leaving these for the next crew to come back to Mars, then why is he putting it all in layman's terms? Because surely they'll all be astronauts. But
what you've done there, Matt, is you've actually thought logically about film, and that you're not allowed to do that. You can't. That's not right.
Well, I mean, I explained it away as he's doing it for his own benefit. He's sort of talking to himself to take himself through his own thought process and stop himself going crazy.
Yes,
effectively. What's interesting is, unlike those other movies I talked about, it wouldn't actually be that much of a big deal if he was annoying, or if you did find those sort of verbal tics or his turns of phrase irritating, because it's not like Moon, where Sam Rockwell is literally the only character in the entire movie. Only about half of the Martian is with Matt Damon on Mars, and for the rest, we get the rescue effort back on Earth and the ship full of his shipmates heading back to Earth without him. And so it is actually a movie about everybody coming together to solve this problem.
Team.
It's a fantastically
diverse... That was some fantastic input from Ellie.
Yeah, it's cheerleading. It makes you want to cheerlead everybody in it and cheer them on to achieve what they want to achieve. It's a fantastically diverse movie. It's sort of an international effort to try and bring this astronaut home. And
is there a lot of camaraderie?
There's a lot of camaraderie.
There is. You would like it, yeah. Ellie. Ellie does have a...
I'd have a little cry.
Yeah.
There's a lot of women and people of colour in prominent sort of scientist-type roles.
Well done.
Yeah. General scientist job role.
Yeah. Loads of women defined by their role. And we've talked about this a lot on the show before, defined by their role rather than by their relationship to a man.
We're going to talk about that more later as well, particularly with science, because of Photograph 51.
Themes. And so one of the things that's interesting about it is it's sort of it's been described in the press materials as it's a movie without a baddie. It's all the different people might have different ideas about the best way to bring Watney home, and there is certainly some character conflict between, for instance, I think it's Jeff Daniels and Sean Bean's characters clash over what is the best strategy.
Does Sean Bean survive the film?
Sean Bean survives
I'm
the
sorry,
film.
But what? This is one thing that I'm going to throw out there. He does survive. Also, I cannot understand a word that man is saying. What is going on with that?
What, because he's off of Yorkshire?
No, it's not even that. He just mumbles. He just mumbles the whole way through this film.
Is he trying to do an accent, or is he just...
No!
Mumbling? He's himself.
I think he's playing a character. But that character is a mumbling...
It's much better
Yorkshireman.
Yeah!
Well, but maybe he was trying to not... be so Sean Bean so he didn't get killed in the film.
But then he just became even more Sean Bean by mumbling the entire... Anyway, sorry.
Yeah, he is a sort of a curmudgeon.
He's
the one who's putting the crew's mental well-being at the heart of everything rather than sort of the cold equations of can we make the science work?
I think in saying, like what you said about not being a baddie, I hadn't actually thought about that. But in watching the film, Jeff Daniels, who plays... the head of NASA?
He's the head of NASA, yeah.
Yeah. He sort of jumped out to me as being the bad guy because he was kind of, you know, not thinking about the well-being of... I think in so many words he says, let's just leave him there.
He sort of says, let's leave him there longer in order to not endanger more people. Like, he's still...
Yeah.
This is the way I saw it was he's still working towards wanting to bring him home but trying to do it with the least risk to other people. So he's definitely the... If you were going to boo someone, it's him. And he's definitely the conservative and sort of the risk-averse person. But equally, he's the one that you keep seeing on the press podiums having to justify everything that they're doing and having to get up and make the embarrassing speech that, oh, the guy we thought we was dead is actually marooned on Mars.
Yeah, we left him there.
Yeah.
Whoops. It's so funny because I wanted to hate this film so much. You have no idea how much I wanted to hate it. Because, you know, notoriously I don't like things that are about space. But I think I liked this because, A, Matt Damon's fantastic in it. B, the script is brilliant, I thought.
Is.
And see, it's not really that much about space, really. It's just about Mars, and it's about, you know, him, as you said, problem solving his way through, you know, all these quite ludicrous situations, and, you know, just being really charming about it. And I just really want to have a beer down the pub with him. And
I've got another theory about maybe why you liked it.
Why?
Because Matt said there wasn't a particular enemy, but maybe the enemy is space. And so if space is the bad guy, you like the film.
Well, now.
Ba, ba, ba.
That's interesting. But yeah, definitely, I think out of the bad guy conversation, Mars is the bad guy, or slash space. That's the answer to that question.
Yeah, Vicky suggested when we were having this conversation before the show, the only other movie that came to mind that has that similar setup is things like The Day After Tomorrow, where the environment is the bad guy and everybody's just trying to survive.
And like Twister and Tornado and all those.
But equally, those are disaster movies where everyone's trying to survive, as opposed to they all have a goal that they're trying to achieve by working together.
Yeah, but you could essentially say that a lot of the people in this film are trying to survive, like make him survive.
Yeah.
So it's sort of an extension survival mechanism of him, you know, going out to everyone else, which I think is interesting. Can we talk a little bit? You guys will really like this. The soundtrack of this film is so like, if I say it to you, it's all disco. And it's a funny joke because basically
Jessica Chastain's character.
Yeah, so she's the
she's the head of the science team, effectively.
Yes, so she's like the big captain of the ship, and she's the only one that was allowed to bring music, apparently. And he's just stuck with all of her disco, and he listens to it throughout the whole, like, it just soundtracks the whole film brilliantly, and it's hilarious because he's just like, you know, dancing around and trying to grow potatoes. It's such a good film. Please go and see it. I'm taking on Matt's role this week. I'm like, go and see this film. It's really good.
It's doing really well. So it seems like a lot of people have already taken that advice. But yeah, go. It's worth a watch.
Yeah, and I think from the people that I've spoken to who have read the book. You haven't read the book, have you, Matt?
No, I haven't.
Apparently, it does it justice very well. So if you're in that sort of bank of people who read a book and go, oh my goodness, this movie's not going to do it justice at all, I've got it on good authority that it does. So that's good. But yeah, I loved it. I think this is the most excited
this
I've been.
This is a landmark.
I know.
Yeah. Wow.
So that's a thing. Matt, do you know what you're doing in a couple of weeks' time?
I might catch up on The Walk, which is Joseph Gordon-Levitt tightrope walking between the Twin Towers, or I might try Sicario, which is the FBI v Mexican drug dealers with Emily Blunt and Josh Brolin, which sounds...
Oh, okay. Is that
those
the
are
one
people I will watch.
She's quite big on the billboards.
Yeah.
She's like
I think she's the main character in it, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, cool. That's good. I like the sound of The Walk. I'd go see that.
Okay.
Oh, I was going to say the other one. Controversial.
Oh, okay.
Well, I won't be here, I don't think, next time.
But that's so okay. Helen, I can fight it out off air about that.
Tweet me if you have another opinion.
Yes, please
at
do.
At Matt Boothman on Twitter.
And if you want to tweet us at the show as well, we are Blackshaw Update on Twitter. So talk to us.
Yes.
We're on the Twitter. Ellie's looking at the Twitter right now.
I'm doing a tweet.
She'll tweet at you. Yeah. So we're going to move into... an interview now with our friends at Cypher's Theatre. They are talking to us about Henry V, which is coming up for them the weekend after next at the Proud Archivist in London. Obviously, we have spent a lot of time with Cypher's on the Blackshaw Arts Hour. We went and saw their show Great Expectations at the start of the year. Ellie, you saw that with us.
I did,
you?
Yes.
Yeah. Obviously, we've been banging on about how we've recently recorded Great Expectations for the radio.
Yep.
And that's coming to you in 2016, which is terrifying to say because Hooray. That's right around the corner. So yeah, here is the interview with Cyphers about Henry V. Okay, so we're talking Henry V, and I am sitting here with Marcus Baisley, the artistic director of Cyphers, and Marcus is directing Henry.
Yes, I am.
And also cast members Rupert Sadler.
Hello.
And Paul Anthony are with us.
Hello.
And we're talking Henry, Marcus. First off, I think I'm interested as to why you're doing Henry with Cyphers.
Well, Henry V is quite an important play for us as a company, really. The name Cyphers comes from the prologue to Henry V. It was the first play we did just over a year ago. And we we're coming back to it this year because it's the 600th anniversary of the Battle of Agincourt, which is the whole centrepiece of the play. But the really fascinating thing about the play for me, and why it was the first play we did, why it's what was in the title of the company, is because it opens with the actors coming on stage and saying, look, we can't really do this. We need your help. And I just love that openness and vulnerability of a cast and the honesty of that, just saying, help us and use your imagination. And for me, that's what theatre's all about, getting the audience to work with the actors and use their imagination to create a world that's personal to them and unique.
I think it's probably something, correct me if I'm wrong, that's probably shaped Cyphers a lot, this play.
Yeah, definitely has. Definitely
I mean,
has.
The last time we spoke to you guys, we were talking Great Expectations, which you put on at the same venue at the beginning of the year.
Mm.
And that was very much the audience had to, you know, use a lot of their imagination because you don't use a lot of set or lighting.
And introducing the chorus into that play as well. I wouldn't have introduced the chorus into Great Expectations if we hadn't started with Henry V.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So throwing it over to cast members, one new, one old, because you've done it before. Rupert, what is different to this version of Henry for you?
What is different? Good question. Honestly, the whole thing feels like something great because you can return to it, which is I've never done with a play before. I've never gone back to a character. Because whenever you finish a play as an actor, you're always like, oh, I wish I could have done the Dauphin this way. I wish I could have done this that way. Oh, if only. But now you get the chance to properly do the thing you always think about when you've finished a play. And in rehearsals, I've personally felt that because we've got new cast members and we're trying things out a bit differently, we're working together and we're realising, oh, we've never done this scene before this way. I mean, we just did the first scene in sort of Henry's throne room. And then when we did it, we just did it off the cuff and we were like, wow, that's never been like how we've done it before. That is completely different in atmosphere, completely different in how we staged it. And that's refreshing because you don't want to do the same play again. As great as the original production was, no offense at that. I mean, I love doing that one, but you want to make sure it's always fresh and you're doing something new every night and every time you do a play, or else, you know, as an actor creatively, you're just a bit sort of, eh.
Yeah.
I think Henry V was the first play we ever did as a company, and I view it as a kind of pivotal play for me as a director because it marked a shift in the way that I worked, and I've now had a year to develop and hone the way that I work, and so it's been really lovely for me to come back to the play and treat it just slightly differently.
Mm.
And I think Paul has brought a different quality to the lead role, which immediately shapes the rest of the play as well.
Yeah,
just to bring Paul into the conversation.
to bring Paul into the conversation. So Paul, you're playing Henry,
yes.
And this is the first time you've ever worked with Cyphers.
Indeed, yes.
How are you finding coming into a play that has been put on before with three cast members who were in the original?
Well, it's actually not a new experience for me in that sense, because the last play I just did Much Ado About Nothing. It was the same thing, they'd done it before, and then I was a new cast member coming in. I mean, it's lovely in terms of there's already a really friendly atmosphere. There's people already know each other, and that kind of like rubs off on you as a warmth. And there's also a kind of a wonderful safety to it, because you know people already know the ins and outs of the rehearsal process, but at the same time it's still quite scary and daunting to kind of go into that. Especially playing Henry, which is, you know,
that's a pretty big character.
Yeah,
I guess.
I mean it's exciting but incredibly, you know, nerve-wracking even now to think of it. In a few weeks we're going to be up there doing it.
Yeah,
it's such a well-known part that it's kind of, yeah, it's one of those ones you always want to do, but then when you get it given it, you're like, oh my god, oh my word. But yeah,
this is a big job.
Yeah.
Marcus, in terms of the way that you work and the way that you run your rehearsals, you were saying before that you're sort of having to work a little bit differently because you're quite conscious of bringing people in who haven't ever worked with you before, but also having people who are used to the way that you work. How have you had to change rehearsals?
Well, it's something that I'm having to work out as I go along, to be honest.
That must be fun, though, I guess.
Yes, it is. It's a challenge, and I'm glad that it's a challenge, because I want to keep developing, and this is a new approach that I'm finding as I go along anyway. It is a challenge to find, because there's a lot of exercises that I would normally do to build an ensemble that I've found actually now enforces the distinction between those that have done it before and those that haven't. Because there's already a really strong sense of trust between the original cast, and that has to develop. So I'm having to sort of think a bit on my feet about how to find new ways and actually sort of, I think my key now is surprising the older cast members, giving them things that they haven't done before and making them feel like this is new, rather than we're with the same strategy and the same technique.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the actual play itself now. I don't know anything about Henry V, but I'm going to throw it over to Paul as the newest person involved in this production.
I was like, oh no.
You're welcome, Marcus. So could you run our listeners through what this play is about, how many people are involved? Obviously, you're playing Henry.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there's six of us playing. How many roles?
That's a director question.
30 roles.
Do you say 30?
Yes. There's quite a few people in, and that's actually, considering we've cut the play a bit,
it's 90 minutes long, and the original would be about 2.5 hours. We've actually added an extra actor in from last time as well. So, but most people play sort of six or seven parts.
Yeah, thankfully, I only play one.
You got the good deal, I think, there.
Yeah. But anyway, so it's Henry V, what's it about? So it's about Henry V, and it's actually the fourth part of a quartet.
The tetrarchy, don't they? The tetrarchy.
So Richard II and Henry IV's part one and two, and this is the final part. So Henry V is the second Lancastrian king, his father had quite a messy time of it because he usurped the throne. And Henry, it becomes, certainly the way Shakespeare wrote him, becomes this very unifying king who goes off bravely into battle and secures some old lands. Henry starts off the play asking for permission to go to war from Parliament, but from what it was then, and they agree, and he goes off, and he doesn't have a great time of it. He wins one battle, he captures Harfleur, and then kind of goes around the country, and lots of his troops die, and then the French kind of track him all the way, and he goes, I want to go back to Calais, I want to go back to England, and they go, no, we're going to fight you. And he goes, well, I've only got about 3,000 men, you've got, how many men do you have? It's 5-1. Worked out.
3,000. Yeah.
So anyway, they go to battle, and the odds are stacked against them, but they win, as you know, if you know the history. And then he goes back to England, comes back to France, and they sign a treaty of Troyes. Yeah. And he gets basically made heir to the Kingdom of France, which sadly doesn't actually ever get crowned king because he dies before Charles VII, the sixth of France. But yeah.
And that's.
Now no one needs to see the play.
Yeah, I'm going to.
To be fair, the chorus does pretty much tell you that in the first scene.
Yeah, and I think most people will know. One thing that's quite interesting about having both of you guys here is that Rupert in Great Expectations, which we have promoted heavily, and I went and saw and we reviewed it on the show, Rupert did no multi-rolling.
Yes, I was in a similar boat as you, which was weird, especially going from multiple characters being all these French posh toffs and soldiers and stuff, and then going into this one character who just evolves over a longer span of time from being a child and then being essentially, you know, full-grown man. So it was interesting, that shift and that change. But it's quite interesting that in Cyphers we've got this chorus and this sort of singular character we always have so far. And it seems to be there's always a different atmosphere, almost. It's hard to explain, but in Great Expectations, it's really the chorus, instead of it being this, oh, we're telling you the story, this myth, this legend, it's more, this is a personal story, this is a a family album, a photo album of my life, and not the best life, mind you. And obviously the character's a lot different. I mean, Pip, in comparison to the King of England, Pip's just a bit of a weedy little gentleman, to be honest. But both plays we've done are very interesting because they're stories that are just have, despite the scale of them, either in Victorian England or in, you know, Agincourt, they always have a very strong human core. I mean, for a mythic character like Henry, it's fascinating just how human he can be. And one of my favourite scenes of Henry V is the scene where Henry talks about "What art thou, ceremony, thou idle ceremony?" And it's a really powerful, heartbreaking scene almost, because it's just that Henry is this character to always put on personas and stuff, and then moving on to Pip and stuff. It's that very similar thing. There's a sense of awful sadness about it all, about putting on these roles and things, but fascinating all the same and really great, I'm sure, as you know, Paul, to get into that one character's head. It's very rewarding to do that, but multi-rolling is rewarding too.
I think that's what I really like about going to see Cypher's productions is the fact that I can see that there's so much time and effort put in by you, Marcus, into character development, especially when you're doing so much multi-rolling. But also when you've got, you know, you've got to develop a character like Henry V, like, yeah. And also like Pip to an extent, like, you know, you've got to do a lot of work there.
The thing that's not, because we haven't really, in this rehearsal period, we haven't got into it yet, but whenever we do the character work, we do it as a group. So every member of the company works on every character together. So everyone has ownership of it and everyone's able to feed in different bits of knowledge. So Paul's Henry will have bits of what of Rupert's Henry and bits of the girls' Henrys and bits of the rest of the cast Henrys. You know, everyone's contributing to it. Which I think is really a really important aspect of
And I think it really shows in your character development because it is very multifaceted. Do you want to talk a little bit about taking it up to Northampton, which is something I don't think you guys have... You've never done that before,
no,
have you?
No, we haven't. No.
Going on the road.
No, it's a big change. Well, not change, but it's a big step for us as a company, really. We've previously, it's always been sort of fairly safe week-long runs at a venue that we've developed a really nice relationship at the Proud Archivist in London. And now we've got the opportunity to take that outside of the capital, go up to Northampton, and we've got an amazing space there. I mean, a truly stunning Norman church with 8 colossal pillars that go right up into the ceiling. It's about as far removed from the Proud Archivist in London as you can get. So it's a challenge for us. I don't view it too much as a challenge in terms of changing the play for the space, because the way it's directed is so free anyway. And I think everyone will just naturally respond to the setting that they're in. But it is a challenge for, as an artistic director and on the production side of things, it's a new challenge. But we've got a fantastic team around us, and that it's grown as well. The whole company has grown. If you sit on the website, you can see how the team around the company has grown with each production, and it's the biggest one we've ever had.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic what you guys are doing. Can you give us the dates for Proud Archivist and Northampton? Tell people where to go to direct them to buy tickets. Mm-hmm. And also, I'm going to ask you the horrible question. I'm going to open up to everyone. Why should people go and see this play?
Okay.
But Marcus,
I'll start with the easy one. So we're at the Proud Archivist in London from the 23rd to the 25th of October, with 2 shows on the 25th, a matinee and an evening show. And in between, because that 25th is the actual anniversary day, we've got a little selection of readings from Henry's actual life, sort of historical accounts. So that's 9 o'clock on the Friday, 9 o'clock on the Saturday, and then 2 and 7 on the Sunday. We go straight up to Northampton, and then we're performing in Northampton from the 27th to the 31st with 2 shows, again, a matinee on the Saturday and a matinee on the Thursday. So there's 7 shows in Northampton in total. And tickets, the best place to go for tickets is our website, which is cyphers.org.uk.
So who wants to start with the question of why should people go and see this play?
Well,
Paul.
Firstly, obviously Shakespeare wrote some good plays.
They're okay.
This one's
an
absolute belter. and I think especially whether you've seen the play before or you haven't, I think the way that we're doing is new and unique, and it's full of energy and fun, and would just be a very good way of spending 90 minutes.
Good answer. Very, very good answer.
Sweeping statement here, but this is the way you should watch Shakespeare, in my opinion. It's,
wow.
Yeah, I know, pretty bold putting it out there, but to be fair, this is Shakespeare wrote his plays so that to include everyone, and it was very much a, you know, use your imaginations, we're going to work with you, and this is, you know, the only time I've worked with Shakespeare where I very much felt, no matter where we've performed it or when we've performed it, it is just like a typical, genuine, heartfelt Shakespeare play. So, yeah.
Marcus, do you want to have a go at answering
this? Yeah, I'll give it a go. It's an opportunity to see Shakespeare, or just play a theatre in general, that is for you. It's not a group of actors standing on stage saying, look at us and look how brilliant we are. It's saying, come with us, have a good time. It's going to be different every single time. It's relaxed, it's informal, but we know exactly what we're doing and we're going to have a good time doing it.
That's a good sell. I like your sell. Go and see Henry V. Cyphers are putting it on. Thank you to Marcus, Paul and Rupert.
Thank you.
That was a lovely interview I did with Marcus, Paul and Rupert of Cyphers Theatre. They are promoting their upcoming production of Henry V, which is playing at the Proud Archivist from the 23rd to the 25th of October. I'm going on the Friday on the 23rd if you want to maybe see me or something.
Friends.
Yeah. And then, as they said in that interview, they're also doing a first for Cyphers. They're taking it on the road up to Northampton at the Holy Sepulchre. Mm. We were just discussing the word sepulchre in the break there. And they are doing that from the 27th to the 31st of October. If you want tickets, go to cyphers.org.uk and you can find them there. So yeah, that was that. And this we are forfeiting.
Is that
arts.
Our new segue? That was that, and this is this.
I love it.
Is that not good?
It works for everything.
No, we really liked it. Okay. We're excited.
I feel like you're all laughing at me.
No.
Look
no,
at this, fine. Not laughing.
Okay. As I was just saying, arts thing is not a thing this week. Helen's in the place of Vicky, only because we have such a full show, not because we don't like Vicky anymore. We do very much like Vicky and her
literally
arts
no
things.
One was thinking that. Now they are thinking it. You just made it really awkward.
I hope Vicky's not listening. That's going to be really awkward.
Art's nothing of the week.
Sorry, Vic.
Right?
Yeah. Anyway, I'll tell you now what we're not doing, what we are doing. Wow, I've confused myself now. Thanks, guys. Helen is going to review Photograph 51, which we spoke about a couple of weeks ago, and I was very excited about the idea of Nicole Kidman being on stage, and I'm interested to know how it was.
It was good. I really liked it.
Oh, that's good. That's the review done.
Yeah. Right. No, I'm going to whiz really quickly through what the play is about. This is from the Dauphin Macintosh website. Does Rosalind Franklin know how precious her photograph is? In the race to unlock the secret of life, she could hold the key. With rival scientists looking everywhere for the answer, who will be the first to see it and, more importantly, understand it? Anna Ziegler's extraordinary play looks at the woman who cracked DNA and asks what is sacrificed in the pursuit of science, love, and a place in history. I say love, funnily, because I don't really think it's about love.
Oh, okay.
Right, so... as that said, Nicole Kidman played Dr. Rosalind Franklin, and she's the person who was using the microscopes and managing to take photographs of DNA. And she should have been the one who is credited with discovering the double helix.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so it's all real?
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm just clocking in. Good.
It's okay. Yeah. Sorry, I should have clarified that.
No, that's okay. It's fine.
So basically, the play dissects why her contribution to the discovery of the double helix and understanding of DNA as a whole has been overlooked, because vocal hands up in the room, who's heard of Dr. Rosalind Franklin?
There is no hands up in the room for anyone playing along at home.
Yeah, cool. But people might have heard that the discovery of the double helix happened at Cambridge, and Sir Francis Crick is like a big deal in that, but it's quite complicated. So basically, the play has a load of guy scientists talking about Dr. Rosalind Franklin and going in and out of their memories with her and talking with her. So she doesn't discuss herself in the present day at all. There is a reason for that, but it's interesting that a play with this subject matter is done in that style.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, the reason why she's not got proper credit is because of her gender. These guys at Cambridge basically used the rumour mill and manipulated people to get information from the work that was being done at King's College to move on with their theory of the double helix. But Rosalind Franklin was the one that had the photograph of the double helix. So she was the one that... So it's quite painful in that way. She's quite a professional, serious person by all their descriptions and through Nicole Kidman's performance. And men subconsciously want more warmth from women, regardless of their relationship with them, I would argue. And so basically the men don't like this woman and they don't respect her science sufficiently, so they think that they can just... slag her off and steal her science. Eventually, because she had to work so much with x-rays to get the work done that she did, she died of cancer very suddenly.
Really?
Yeah. Double ovarian cancer.
Ooh.
Which, considering she's a female scientist, it's just so brutal. You actually couldn't make it up, I don't think. So I would say, right, the modern equivalent of this, I think, is street harassment. Like, mm-hmm. men want a certain thing from a woman, regardless of what they give them and regardless of who that woman is. And that's exactly what happened with Dr. Rosalind Franklin. The play is sort of played as if it's like a thriller and a mystery, but it's much more tragic to me than that. So it could have been played really differently. It's a new play, and I think it'll be interesting when it's put on again. It was directed by Michael Grandage this time, and I think it'll be interesting to see someone else do it.
Right.
For me, it's kind of maybe a problem, but maybe it's a good thing, because it's definitely done on purpose, that the play is from the viewpoint of all of these men round Dr. Franklin. So they sort of... they argue amongst themselves about whether the idea was stolen and whether she was treated properly. Because there is this guy who's clearly in love with her there, trying to fight her corner.
Mm-hmm.
But that's all a bit curious, and the fact that she's represented only in the past. She's the object at the centre of the play, but she is an object.
Yeah, and that's the very reason why she wasn't ever respected or, like, you know, made note of scientifically.
Exactly.
Maybe... do you think that that's something they've done on purpose?
Yes.
To really accentuate the fact,
yes,
that she was just someone who was made an object and not taken seriously?
Yeah, I think so. I think how it's sort of directed in quite a stark way. The set is really minimal. The lighting's really cold and brutal. So, yeah, it's almost like it's got this clinical staring down upon her and her life.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a really, really interesting play, but it's interesting at the end. I went with my other half, who's quite into his science, and my sister was like, "Oh, you two would have really liked that." And I was like, "Yeah, there was something for everyone. Straight out of the science, and I had the feminism." My sister was like, "It's not feminist," and I was like, "Oh, because it isn't feminist in terms of it showing that, you know, really poor treatment of this woman." Mm. But I would argue that the fact that it's just laid so bare like that is a, it makes it actually a feminist play. But yeah, it's really fascinating. I don't know, yeah, if anybody's ever seen anything similar. I don't know
was
if I
it,
have.
Was it a comfortable watch?
It no, seems, not entirely.
No, I feel like from this review alone, you seem quite uncomfortable talking about it. So I can't imagine what it was like actually seeing it.
I really enjoyed seeing it. I think it's just because I'm quite right on that. that I sound uncomfortable. It's I think it hit a nerve with me.
Yeah.
In that regard, I work for a university, and I work for a university that was in the press quite recently for something that was said by a very senior male about women, and it wasn't cool.
So it's still very relevant.
Yes.
And
I think that's.
And I think it's interesting that you said, you know, one of you said it's feminist, one says it's not, but it, regardless of what you think, it's starting a dialogue about feminist topics.
Exactly.
So.
Yeah, wow. That was a really intense review.
But, so probably not something for light relief.
No.
But definitely something if you want to see something thought-provoking.
Yeah. We went on a family outing and we did all really enjoy it. The performances are really good. And, you know, there are bits in it that are funny. It's not a miserable watch, but it's not a happy story either.
Okay. That's good to know. Thank you so much, Helen, for reviewing that for us. That's running up until the 21st of November, by the way, if you want to go and catch that at the Noel Coward Theatre. Would we like to talk a little bit briefly about what's going up with Blackshaw right now? Helen, you've got some stuff in the bag about Scarceland.
Okay. So we've talked about it on the show a bit before. On the 25th of November, we are holding a slightly different night of new stories than we normally do. Normally, we would have like a new writing night with lovely actors and a bit of staging. But this is going to be more of a stripped-down sort of person and microphone affair. And we want to hear your scary stories, basically. So and then we're going to record that whole night and then put it out as the show.
We are doing that. Yeah. So if you can't actually come to the Horse and Stables in Lambeth North, then you can listen to it on the radio on the Blackshaw Arts Hour on Wandsworth Radio. So, you know, we're really catering for everyone here.
Yeah.
For people that can't get out and also people who don't like to go out.
Yeah, people who really like scary stories but want to stay locked up at home.
Yeah,
there's an option.
That's fair enough. You can listen to it on the radio with all the lights on and not be terrified.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And there's also the option to take part, am I right?
Absolutely, yeah. The full information about this is on the Blackshaw blog, but it might be that somebody in this room with us in the studio is going to be telling a scary story. It might be that two people in this room are going to tell us a scary story. But you can drop me an email, helen@blackshawonline.com, to get more information or to sign yourself up to tell a story. The only thing I really ask is that you don't need big tech requirements, like I said, and that the story is your own. So
get in touch and you can be a part of our Scarceland, which is a Blackshaw first as well. Now we're going to go into some Staying Alive content. We're going to hear first up an interview with Emily Ray, who is playing the part, she's playing three parts actually in Staying Alive. She's playing the part of Sarah, Portia and a social worker. And this is an interview that Helen, our lovely Helen in the studio, has done for us.
My name is Emily Ray. And I play three characters. The first is Portia, the second is Sarah, and then I also play the social worker.
How does it feel multi-rolling when you're the only one that's really doing that?
I like it. I like the way people are on stage and I pop off and come back out in another outfit.
Yeah.
But I think it's also quite useful because particularly for Will's character, there are comments from the other characters about how there's a new pair of legs at every dinner party that he brings along, and I think by having the same actor, that kind of helps the audience understand, you know, this bloke keeps arriving with various ladies.
Yeah,
and that lady's me in different forms.
Yeah, I thought that was quite a good joke in the showcase, actually. I enjoyed that.
Yeah.
But I suppose the social worker is something very different then.
Yeah. And we also talked about the fact that the social worker and Sarah have their similarities. So, I mean, Portia is on another level. She's completely different. But Sarah and the social worker, I think, have the same level of kindness. And that's kind of what Mary sees in Sarah. And that's kind of what triggers her flashback into her first encounter of the social worker. So I like that they share that and that Portia's so different.
Could you talk me through your involvement with Staying Alive?
So I knew that this play was the award winner, and having performed in Alice in Wonderland previously, I've worked with Blackshaw a few times, and I just kind of knew that whatever they were doing, I wanted to be in it.
Oh, that's excellent.
So I just applied, and I wasn't sure about the characters at first. I wasn't sure what they'd be looking for, but I'm so pleased that I have managed to suit three characters, and that's all worked out, because I think you have to be quite specific because they're so different, you know.
Have you done much multi-rolling before?
Only in children's theatre, so very, very different.
Yeah.
Very different multi-rolling. And a little bit in kind of Shakespeare drama school, but not really. This is kind of my first like proper grown-up play, playing three grown-up characters, which I'm really excited about.
In what way is it different playing three characters in a grown-up play to in a children's play?
With children's theatre, you kind of have to do less as an actor because it's more to do with I've gone off stage and I've put on a different hat and now the children know that I'm somebody else. Whereas it's clearly still me in this play, and I think I have to work a lot harder to make it clear that they're different characters, but it's a really welcome challenge, and I just absolutely love playing humans as opposed to frolicking around the stage.
Well, maybe yeah. Ellie Pitkin just thought she'd given you too easy a time in Alice.
Maybe.
Where you could just be Alice all the way through and everyone else was running around like yeah, those chickens.
Maybe.
Yeah, so she thought, yeah, let's get Emily to work a bit harder.
Maybe.
So, can you talk to me a bit about what you feel the play is about? On the surface, it's about bereavement, but I suppose Portia's doesn't have that much to do with that element, except maybe putting her foot in it every now and again.
Yeah, well, she stirs things up. She's kind of like a great example of how not to deal with bereavement and general social situations where you're new to everybody. It's just a lesson in how not to behave, really, is Portia. But I think that's why she's so useful as a character.
Right.
Because she just goes for it, and it all goes horribly wrong. But I also think that the play is heavily about friendship and also about how humans interact with each other through difficult times. Like, I don't know, is that too long to be a theme? But
no.
It's just all under the surface and so little of it if people feel they're able to talk about, and I think that can be applied to just every day, you know, not just with bereavement, but you know, hi, how are you? I'm fine, thanks, how are you? It's like scripted, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I don't know, that is a theme, I would say.
Yeah, I would agree. I really felt that came across well in the showcase, but I really can't express why that is. Was there anything particular you did while you were rehearsing that brought that to life?
We did talk about that, how and also the fact that the play is set across quite a lot of dinner parties and how that's the kind of perfect setting in which you're meant to behave and say that you're well and positive, and it's just not really the environment to say I'm really struggling or I'm really unhappy or so it was, I mean, a great idea on Kat's part, the writer, to set it then, because what better situation in which to, you know, cover up how you're feeling. And of course Mary tries to do that, but it's the elephant in the room.
Were you at the meeting with Nick from Slow?
Yes.
How was that?
I mean, harrowing and uplifting. Oh. if it can be those things.
Okay.
She's such an interesting and inspirational woman. She was so open answering our questions and really didn't hold back at all. And I think although we'd all been working really hard in, you know, separately away character work, trying to really build an idea of what that grief is like, given that none of us are parents, it just really all fell into place when we spoke to her.
So did you feel that was particularly useful for playing the social worker, maybe?
Yeah, so much. I did ask her a few questions, and I'm not sure how much interaction she had with social workers through her own experience of losing her child, but just generally in terms of, like, tone and what to say, we talked through that, and that was really helpful. I just feel very touched that she came to see us and then came to see the show and was really supportive of it and laughed and cried, and I'm glad that she enjoyed the humour as well.
Is there anything that you're particularly looking forward to sort of diving back in with the play, or anything that you want to do over or expand on from before?
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't given it much thought except kept having done a little read through of an extra, like an addition to a scene, and it without giving too much away, it definitely enhances more moments between Sarah and Will, which previously have been kind of that ain't going anywhere, that relationship, and this just gives a little bit more insight into Will and therefore gives Sarah a bit more drive into maybe wanting to get to know Will or not.
Ooh.
But yes, it's nice. There's additions to all of the characters, I think, that just give us even more depth than we had before, which is good and exciting.
Great. Well, hopefully I'll get to catch up with you at some point during rehearsals.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for talking to me today.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
So that was an interview with Helen Johnson and Emily Ray. Emily plays one of the characters in our upcoming production of Staying Alive. This next interview that I'm going to play for you is an interview by Helen again with Stephen Ashmore Blakely, who plays the part of Will.
My name is Stephen Ashmore Blakely, and I play Will. I'm not quite sure whether Will, he's somewhere between a lost soul and a lost cause. I expect Will is someone who works in a marketing capacity, although he likes to call it advertising because he thinks that's a bit cooler. And image is very important to Will, not only in terms of his work, which I think blurs with his kind of personal life, but also the image that he portrays to people and those around him. Some would call him shallow and misogynist, but I think that would be unkind.
Would you say that Will is a comedy character in a dark play?
He's not intrinsic to the whole plot, his character, but he does offer light relief in one level. So I think you're right. I think that one can build on that, because I think what he reflects, which is maybe a kind of broader sense of the whole piece, is this awkwardness. And I'm not sure it's particularly British, but I'm going to say it's particularly British.
Mm.
You wouldn't find the Italians doing this, for example. You know, this kind of very English-British restraint around dealing with things that might be anywhere emotional. So I think he brings to the play a comedic element, but there's also an undertone, which is this awkwardness about people either having something to say about death or nothing to say, and if it's something to say, it's normally the wrong thing and it's normally misplaced, particularly within your group of friends.
When did you first get involved with Staying Alive? What's your background?
Kat and I trained at drama school, and then Blackshaw Theatre ran, as I'm sure you know, a competition, which is New Writing Night. And Kat won that, and then Blackshaw Theatre went on Casting Call Pro, I think it was, and said we'd like to ask for auditions, and I put my hat in the ring, and we all turned up to a pub in Tooting and went upstairs and auditioned, and I got the part, and I'm just thrilled that someone's backed it, and there's the energy and the commitment to put it on for a 3-week run, because it's, I mean, I would say this, but it is a fantastic piece of writing, because it doesn't, you know, with the sort of subject matter, it could go very easily slapstick comedy, or it could go kind of very miserable, very reflective, introspective, and it's not, because it tells the truth. And when you tell the truth, people can both sympathise, empathise, and they can connect to it in both a visceral and cerebral way.
Have you performed in much new writing before?
Yes, I have, actually. It's what most people come out of drama school do.
Do you like it?
Yeah, no, I do. I do, because I've done a lot of stuff above pubs. Theatre-wise, obviously. And,
sure.
And that was in my youth. I needed the money. And there was a lot of new writers. One particular one called Dean Stallum, who is an ex-convict, and he's actually got a great charity called Art Saves Lives, and he put on quite a few plays which people would determine quite gritty. I mean, Time Out called him, you know, he's like Pinter on speed.
Right.
I did a bit of stuff for him probably 4 or 5 years ago, some stuff with some other people from the Poole School where we trained.
And so it's
great.
Thank you very much for talking to me.
My pleasure. Thank you for taking the time.
So that was Helen Johnson, our lovely Helen Johnson, who sat in the studio with us for this show. She just interviewed Stephen Ashmore Blakely, and he's playing the part of Will in Staying Alive.
Yeah.
Ellie's... That's okay, Ellie. Ellie just touched something and it made a bit of noise.
I'm so sorry.
We're not going for perfection on this show. Speaking of this show, how can people get in touch with us? On this show, Ellie.
On this show, if you want to get in touch about the radio show, you can tweet us at Blackshot Update, or you can comment on our statuses or our wall or all of those technical words on Facebook, which is it's facebook.com/Blackshot Online, and we have a website which is blackshotonline.com, and that's also where you can find lots of really exciting content that we've got coming up surrounding the production of Staying Alive. So tomorrow is going to be our first rehearsal. Excited noises. So tomorrow evening we'll be doing our read through and then first bit of rehearsal, and there will be lots of things coming up online in the next couple of weeks, including photos, there'll be some blogs, there'll be some backstage interviews, more secret chats, and audio content as well, which is going to be housed on a new platform, Aisha. Oh,
yes, that is correct. So you may have, if you were listening to us a fortnight ago, you may have heard us mention the fact that we are a podcast now. We've evolved.
Say what?
Like a butterfly, like a weird caterpillar into a butterfly. We became a podcast, and now we're on iTunes.
Into the 21st century.
Yeah, we just got shot straight into there. So we are the Blackshore Arts Hour on iTunes. You can search us. We're there. You can go to blackshoreonline.com. You can find us through there also.
Yeah, so subscribe. Come and subscribe. Feedback to us.
Click subscribe and you'll be sure to be getting all of the extra bonus content that we don't have time to fit into the radio shows. And there really is some fantastic stuff coming up around Staying Alive and the show.
Yeah, so in a fortnight's time, tune in and we'll have a few secret chats, like what Ellie just mentioned there. I like the word secret chat. It makes people...
it's clandestine.
You know, yeah, it's good. Matt will be back doing another lovely film review. Helen will be about, maybe talking about something she's seen in the last couple of weeks.
I get around to see stuff.
Yeah, yep. You do. We're going to leave you this week on the show with our beautiful Staying Alive audio trailer, which has all the dates in. Have a listen and come along.
Grab
and
a notepad.
Yes, get a notepad and take notes. and come and see Staying Alive, because it's going to be brilliant. And thank you, everyone, for being in the studio.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening.
Yeah, thanks for listening. We'll be back in a fortnight.
Bye.
Miss Evans, have a seat, please.
Mary, it's Mary.
Jen.
What?
I don't know what to say. What am I supposed to do?
I understand that you have had a horrific experience today.
We're her friends, Jack.
I can't say how sorry I am about your son, Henry.
We're supposed to do friendship.
In the event that a child dies unexpectedly in the home, the local authority has a responsibility to find out about what happened.
My nan died once.
Just the once?
Yeah. And I was so sad for, like, weeks.
I know you must feel like you've been singled out, especially when you've already been through so much.
I was hoping that in addition to losing my only child, I wouldn't also have to experience the most awkward night of my life with one of my oldest friends.
My role today is to find out from you what happened to Henry.
God, I know, I'm a mess. I don't know what to say. I saw you and I knew I was going to make it worse.
I promise you, you can't make it worse.
I will need to ask you some difficult questions.
Do you want to talk about it?
I've had cheery conversations.
Mary?
Thought seeing friends would be a comfort.
Do you understand?
There's nothing worse than old friends.
Mary?
They always think they know exactly who you are.
Do you understand?
Yes.
Do you feel that you're ready to proceed?
Blackshaw Theatre presents Staying Alive, a new play by Kat Roberts, showing this November at the Pleasance Theatre. Tickets on sale now at pleasance.co.uk.